More information at macfound.org.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with you, Tuesday edition. What is the appropriate balance between the market and the state in providing opportunities and protection for citizens? Today we visit with author David Rothkopf, the president of an international advisory firm and scholar. His latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And David Rothkopf joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, David. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I always thought that the forerunners of so-called corporations started in the 1700s with the English and the Dutch traders such as East India and that being the pioneers, but you trace it back to the Dark Ages.
Well, in fact, some of the earliest corporations could be found in Roman civilization, but the seedlings for what has grown into the corporate world that we have actually can be traced back to companies that started 1,000 years ago. The oldest company in the world that's still in existence is a company called Stora Enso, was called Stora Kopparberg, which started in Sweden in a copper mine and probably started around the year 1000.
And they still have huge holdings. To what extent?
Well, it started out as a copper company. It went into the timber business. It's now in the paper and packaging business. It's probably $20 billion a year in annual sales. So it's one of the 2,000 biggest companies in the world, but they're 2,000 companies bigger.
Back in the day, I go back to the 1950s, the old saying, what's good for GM is good for the U.S. I guess you wouldn't agree with that.
Well, look, it can be. The guy who, you know, said that was the CEO of GM. I think the point was that, you know, if GM grows, it means the economy is growing and it means that, you know, people are benefiting. What we've seen in the past couple of decades in the United States is that those old relationships don't work anymore. The economy used to grow and more jobs were created and higher paying jobs were created and income inequality fell and social mobility grew. In the past decade, for the first time in U.S. history, the economy grew. We didn't create more jobs. Income inequality got worse. Social mobility declined. And incomes have been falling for the past 3 or 4 decades. So something has gotten broken in the system. One of the things that's gotten broken is that corporations have pushed their agenda in such a way that they're getting a bigger and bigger piece of the pie, and their biggest owners are getting a bigger and bigger piece of the pie, and this is playing to the disadvantage of everybody else.
David Rothkopf, it seems your favorite fort in the book, Power, Inc., is the history of corporations. Take us back for a little more of that, say, pre- and post-industrial revolution, of how the interaction between the corporate world and governments were.
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that when companies got started, you referred to the early part of the 17th century with things like the British East India Company, these companies were created to serve the state. And for the first several hundred years, the idea of a company, a corporation, was to create an enterprise that could go on, survive through the death of its owners and operators, but ultimately advance the interests of generally speaking, since these were monarchies, the crown. And that sort of notion that a company was to serve the greater good is something that ultimately changed. And the place that it started to change the most was in the United States. In the early part of the 19th century, we started developing a new kind of corporate law that had companies breaking off onto their own, breaking away from the idea of serving the state, and starting to serve themselves. And in fact, as they grew and grew, do so in some respects as rivals of the state, rivals of the interests of everybody else in the economy. And that's a very, very big change, because now you've got enterprises, many of which are larger than countries. The top 2,000 companies in the world are probably bigger than the smallest 100 countries in the world. And the very, very biggest companies in terms of their economic size and clout and global reach, companies like Exxon and Walmart, they're roughly the same in terms of their resources and ability to influence outcomes as large countries like Sweden, for example.
So the modern heavies have even more clout, say, than the turn of the century Standard Oil or U.S. Steel?
Well, in some respects they do. Standard Oil at the height of its power, controlled the oil business in the United States in a way that you don't see anymore because of monopoly laws. But, Standard Oil was broken up into seven pieces, and those seven pieces are now their successors. Essentially, make up half a dozen of the very, very biggest companies in the world. So it's not like they went away. But what's happened is that companies were counterbalanced by national laws, not just monopoly laws or antitrust laws, but laws that said we're going to have a government sitting across the table from a corporation, representing the views of the people at large. But in the global era, there are no actors like that that can operate on the global stage to offset the global influence of these companies. So you've got, financial firms that are operating in global derivative markets that aren't effectively regulated because there's no supranational authority to rein them in. You've got global enterprises that are able to game discussions about, say, climate, because there's no supranational governance mechanisms that are able to regulate them effectively in that regard. So in many ways, you've got big global corporations taking advantage of a kind of a gap in the law in much the same way that companies like Standard Oil did earlier in the 19th century prior to the government passing antitrust laws.
It just kind of came up to me that I wonder if what happened in World War II, where the major part of the economy, the auto industry, the steel industry, the coal industry, were completely turned around by government edict to participate in the war effort.
Well, government, look, the notion somehow that governments haven't played a role in the building of the economy or that the American way, for example, is somehow associated with the unfettered growth of free enterprise and companies without government getting in their way is just nonsense. I mean, the reality is, and you don't have to sort of revert to President Obama's language that, no company was started entirely on its own, to acknowledge that the canals, the railroads, the highway system, the internet, the military-industrial complex, as you've described it, all of these things were developed as a kind of public-private partnership with a kind of balance that has fallen out of favor as the rhetoric and the political tilt in the United States since the 1980s has shifted increasingly towards making it, very nearly sacrilegious to suggest that governments ought to, play some role in determining the future of big parts of the economy.
We're speaking with David Rothkopf about his book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. David, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
Okay.
WLRN's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. We're funded by listeners like you and by FPL. More than 10,000 FPL employees are constantly working to make its system stronger, smarter, cleaner, and more efficient so that Floridians will have reliable electric service now and for years to come. More information at FPL.com.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
Hi, this is Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More. Please join me each weeknight at 8 here on 91.3 WLRN. Our door is open to guests from across the spectrum of our multicultural world. We debate the issues of the day and talk about everything: politics, faith, gun control, international adoption, all with a spirit of exploration and inclusion. Join us each weeknight at 8 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR News Station 91.3 WLRN.
And we're back 17 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Excuse me. We resume our conversation with David Rothkopf, and we're talking about his book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. David, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your several books?
The publisher, Macmillan, which Farrar, Straus and Giroux, has a website. I'm the CEO of Foreign Policy Magazine, and people can go to foreignpolicy.com, and I write for foreignpolicy.com, and they can learn about the world at large through our site.
And for our listeners, we'll be putting up a link to the book Power, Inc. at the Topical Currents Facebook page. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question with David Rothkopf, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. And also email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. David Rothkopf, how does U.S. big business power affect competition with rising economic juggernauts such as China, India, and South Korea, which seem to have much more flexibility?
Well, they have different systems. I think one has to sort of disaggregate the question. There are big international companies in places like China and India and so forth that are now global leaders in their field and have the same kind of clout as big U.S. companies. And, in fact, more such big companies are being created in the emerging world right now than in the developed world. So you've got, Mittal Steel is the world's leading steel companies. You're already starting to see ads in the United States for companies like Huawei, and Chinese auto manufacturers are starting to make their way into people's consciousness. But you also have different systems of capitalism around the world. And I think this is maybe even more important because, the Cold War ended and we thought, well, look, we've won. Communism has lost. The American way is going to be the way for the rest of the world. And we viewed that way as a kind of laissez-faire, get out of the way, let markets do what they will, that'll take care of everything approach. But because it started to dysfunction here and because it didn't really jibe with the views of other societies in different parts of the world, what we've seen since the end of the Cold War is the emergence of multiple competing forms of capitalism: European capitalism, Chinese capitalism, democratic development capitalism in big countries like India and Brazil, small state entrepreneurial capitalism in places like, say, Israel or Singapore or the United Arab Emirates. And each one of those has a different balance between the state and the market. Very important, because what it really means is our system may not be the ultimate shape of capitalism. These others may be more influential.
So it's evolving?
Okay, yes. And it has been evolving. It evolved from the point that the center of the government was a monarch and the company served the monarch to a point where nation states emerged and they started to play a regulatory role, but in some such states it was a kind of a very hands-on role, and in communist states the government still controlled the whole market. Now to a system where virtually everybody sees that there needs to be a balance, but But almost everybody is different from the U.S. because almost every other form of capitalism has a bigger role for the state and more of an emphasis on the interests of the community rather than the interests of the individual.
I have an emailer, David Rothkopf, who wants to know your view of the Occupy movement. It seems to have kind of fizzled. What are your views?
Well, I think the problem with the Occupy movement was that it didn't have an ask. You know, it didn't have a political goal. It was more an expression of frustration. In that respect, I think it was very much like its sort of antithesis in the U.S. politics, you know, the Tea Party. Both were politics of alienation movements that were fueled by anger that the system wasn't working for the people in the way people thought it was supposed to. Having said that, it seems to me that that which fueled the Occupy movement, that kind of anger, still remains. And even if the movement itself has faded, you hear some of its themes, 99% versus 1%, even in the mainstream rhetoric of this year's election campaign.
So in the U.S., where is the balance between government regulation and free market creativity, efficiency, and innovation?
Well, I think the balance is shifting, but I think that we have to recognize that, you know, we tend to ask the wrong questions. You know, there's a lot of debates in the United States about, you know, how do we stay number one? But I think the important question is, what do you want to be number one at? You know, the United States may have the biggest economy in the world, but we rank behind dozens of other countries in things like educational achievement or the amount we spend on R&D or the quality of our healthcare system or the quality of life in our country. And, you know, I think if our goal is to have a higher quality of life, then we have to recognize that this sometimes means a better social safety net, less insecurity for people, having the government play a constructive role. But that doesn't mean the markets have to go away. And, you know, there are examples like in Northern Europe, even with all the problems Europe is having, you can look at Northern Europe and you'll see a bunch of countries that are growing faster than us, creating more jobs than us, have free market world-leading companies based in them, but that also lead us by a lot in terms of quality of life, in terms of education, in terms of spending on R&D, in terms of spending on infrastructure. And interestingly, they also lead us in terms of fiscal responsibility. They've got better balances in their budget than we do. So this is not free spending Euro socialism, but rather a different mix, a different recipe for successful market society balance.
Well, skeptics of those systems would say yes, but they're taxed to the gills.
Well, they're taxed a little more than we are, but you know, a tax is a payment. And the question isn't how high your tax is, it's what you're getting for your tax. And if the amount of money that you put into the system actually guarantees you health care, it actually guarantees you quality education, it actually guarantees you security in your old age, it actually guarantees you clean air or clean water or happier society, well, you know, it's not a small thing. And, you know, these societies are making a choice, and I think it's reasonable to have the argument that, you know, about, you know, what the balance ought to be. And, you know, the problem is in the United States right now, if you were to bring up, you know, and say, well, you know, there's a different way, or our way is, you know, imperfect and needs to be perfected, as a politician, that's the third rail. I mean, listen to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's out there, and he uses the word Europe almost as though it's a curse word. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, we don't want to be like Europe. Well, maybe we do want to be like Europe. And, you know, and by the way, it's not just us making this choice. And the rest of the world, in Asia, in Europe, and in emerging parts of the world, Latin America and elsewhere, they're seeking a different mix. And ultimately, they will dictate what the shape of the system is because we are 4% of the world's population.
Again, we're speaking with David Rothkopf about his book, Power, Inc. And if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. email. That's radio@wlrn.org. First caller, we've got David. He's in North Miami Beach. Hey, David. Hi.
Hello. Thank you, gentlemen. I once saw a video of Don Regan telling President Reagan to hurry up. And I was wondering, did we learn the wrong lessons of the Cold War? We defeated communism, capital C. We didn't figure out how to balance between corporatism and democratic socialism. So did we see the chessboard the wrong way, and that led us to our current, imbalance of power?
Yeah, I think we took the wrong lessons from what was happening in terms of world history, and we came out of the Reagan era, the sort of end of the Cold War era, and we were self-congratulatory, and we took the most extreme form of the argument, which is, you know, kind of Milton Friedman capitalism, like, you know, leave the government out of it, let markets take care of things, and we took them to their unreasonable concern. I was a senior official in the Clinton administration. We were touting our more market-oriented approach than some of our Democratic predecessors. And, you know, look what happened at the end of the Clinton administration. We undid the Glass-Steagall rules that separated commercial banks from investment banks. We congratulated ourselves for taking the government out of the market a little further and leaving things to those wise men in the markets to handle, on our behalf. And the world blew up, and the system was wrong, and it was the wrong decision. Now, fortunately for us, we have a system that is designed to reinvent itself, to listen and to adjust. The question is whether our political system has become so corrupted with money that it's now impossible to actually have a fair debate. And I think, you know, that's where you see some really deep problems in the United States. The movement towards equating money with speech through things like the Citizens United decision give people and corporations with vastly more money than the average person vastly more weight. I saw something in the paper today that said that, you know, the $10 million donation of Sheldon Adelson Super PAC, or Sheldon Adelson to a Super PAC, is the equivalent of 200,000 average individual donations to a campaign. Well, who do you think gets listened to? Who do you think sets the rules? Do you think people who write $10 million checks are doing it out of patriotic spirit or because they have an agenda? And if you do that, you've got a system corrupted by money for a long time, the rules get written differently and they tend to favor those few. And that's what's happened in this country. Corporations are playing a big role rewriting rules to suit them. And the consequence is a system that no longer serves everybody in the way it once did.
Okay, David?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for your call. David Rothkopf, tell us about super citizens and semi-states that you talk about in the book.
Well, it's just a device to sort of illustrate the disparity in power between some of these big enterprises and the states that are supposed to be representing the interests of the people at large. You know, super citizens are these 2,000 corporations, many of which are operating in dozens of countries. They've got a set of powers and a diversity of resources that make them formidable in terms of influencing global outcomes. And they are legally obligated not to act in the interest of the public at large. They're legally obligated to act in the interest of a small slice of that public, their shareholders. This doesn't make them evil. It's what they are designed to do. But the problem is, sort of the kind of window dressing of corporate social responsibility arguments aside, is that they would prefer not to have laws regulating how they emit gases into the environment or laws slowing them down in their ability to make the trades and markets that they want to have, or governments that are, you know, adversarial to them in terms of what they might do in terms of tax policies or labor policies and or healthcare policies. And the consequence of all of that is that these big super empowered private actors end up getting their way, influencing outcomes in a lot of states. while states' powers are shrinking over time, you know, and over the course of the past couple of centuries, the things that states used to do to distinguish themselves, you know, they could print money, they could control their borders, they could project force, they could enforce laws. Well, they can't do those things as well as they did before because, well, they, you know, there are only half a dozen states that actually print money, and most of the money is electronic, and most of the value-bearing instruments in the world are derivatives, which are controlled, created by the private sector. There are only probably a dozen countries that can actually project force across a border for more than a couple of days. The ability to enforce laws is undermined when people can operate outside of countries and play venues against each other globally. Certainly, the ability to enforce a border is undermined by things like the internet and progress. So states are getting weaker. Companies are getting stronger. The balance is shifting. And this is not a good thing for everybody who's not a company.
We're speaking with David Rothkopf about his book, Power, Inc. We're going to take another short break and be back with more.
Thanks for joining us for Topical Currents on WLRN. The Theater League of South Florida and WLRN present the WLRN Summer Theater Fest, a tri-county collaboration of youth, community, and equity theater, showcasing some of the best live theater in South Florida. It includes 37 organizations and 87 productions now through August 31st. A complete listing of organizations and performances can be found at WLRN.org when you click on the Theater Fest icon. A look ahead to tomorrow's program.
Hello, it's Joseph Cooper. Join me for Wednesday's Topical Currents and a visit by Occidental College political professor Peter Dreyer. He's assembled a list of 100 greatest Americans of the 20th century, a social justice hall of fame. There are activists, thinkers, and politicians, some who lost, but who gave voice to movements of social justice. That's Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
I'm Ashley Milne-Tite. This Tuesday on The Broad Experience, we examine the current excitement surrounding female entrepreneurship and look at what's real and what's hype. That's The Broad Experience, this Tuesday at 5:50 p.m. during All Things Considered on WLRN.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We resume our conversation with author David Rothkopf. And we're talking about his book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And as I mentioned earlier, we will have a link at the Topical Currents Facebook page if you'd like to learn more about David and the book. So, David, what about the reckoning that lies ahead?
Well, I think, you know, the reckoning that lies ahead has a couple of components. One of the components is this competition between different forms of capitalism. And, you know, if we falter as an economy because we're not providing for people in the way that we did in the past, if we are not competitive in the way that we were in the past, if we're not attuned to changes that are taking place in the global economy, that's going to reduce our influence. Meanwhile, other states are growing more rapidly and their influence is going to grow. You know, when the United States became the center of world power, you know, in the 20th century, the influence that Europe once wielded shifted here. Well, in the century ahead, Asia is going to be the center of world economic power, and they are going to gain that influence, and they have a different view of how markets and societies ought to work. The question is whether we can tweak our system in a way that better suits us, better serves us, and once again makes it an example to the rest of the world where people say, look, they get bigger return for their efforts. They have a better kind of a society. There is more opportunity there. Everybody in the society is rewarded as they once were. We were the example. We're not anymore. That's a reckoning. And then I think, you know, the other kind of reckoning that lies ahead is within our own country, because you do have grotesque inequality where, you know, the top couple of hundred Americans have a net worth that's equivalent to that of the bottom 150 million Americans, where the vast majority of the benefits of our growth from the past decade or the past year or two of recovery have ended up going to the top 1%, and almost no benefits have gone to the bottom 90%. And so, you know, that is not just an economic failure, it's a social failure. The disenfranchised at the bottom of society have less of a chance of moving up in the U.S. from, say, the bottom fifth to the top 40% than they do in other parts of the world. And this can be a source of social tension, political tension, and social collapse. I mean, you know, in our inner cities, the majority of minority students don't graduate high school. They're out of this system. They will never make a decent living.
Especially males, I think.
Right. But what happens to them? You know, they become frustrated, alienated. They turn to crime. They lead miserable lives. You know, they don't have opportunity, and that is the kind of thing that rends the fabric of a society and can be its undoing. And I think we are being callously indifferent to trends that are a real threat to the United States and the way of life in the United States and the stability of our cities and to a lot of things that we've just taken for granted.
Let's take a few phone calls. We have a few lines open, 1-800-743-9576. We've got a plantation listener. This is John. Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, good morning or good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It's one of the great problems we have in our country is deciding whether things are rights or privileges. Because if we, you know, assume them to be a right, and I'll take health care as an example, then that implies a whole set of government interventions versus privilege, which we just sort of leave to the free market. In terms of health care, has anybody looked at the public utility model, which was, you know, incredibly effective in the 30s relating to energy distribution access, things like that. And then I guess the second part of my question is how bad is it, for example, that the American Hospital Association is the fifth most powerful lobbying group in the country? And I'll take my answer off the line.
David Rothkopf?
Well, first of all, there's a multi-part question. I think, you know, it's worth noting that, you know, of all the developed nations in the world, we are the only one that does not have some form of national health care. It takes a lot of hubris for us to say, well, you know, we get this, we understand this better than everybody else, particularly when, by most metrics, most areas of health care coverage can be found better and cheaper elsewhere in the world. So the system isn't working the way it is now, that's not to say that those other systems, you know, don't have their own flaws, and they each have sort of different flaws. As far as the Public Utilities Commission, you know, structure goes, the reality is that did possibly work in the 1930s to get things restarted. But you know, right now, I don't think you'd find an energy company executive or a energy consumer that thinks that Public Utilities Commissions work very well, because they don't adapt well to change. They fragment the country into lots of different parts. And really, the objective with healthcare is to try to control costs by creating economies of scale. This has all been very, very hard for the reason that the caller specified, which is the healthcare industry lobbies like crazy, spends more money, I think, than any other lobby in Washington, and has the ear and influence of both parties. You know, I mean, President Obama made a big effort or deal out of, you know, how he was going to do things differently, and he was not going to be subject to lobbyists, and he was going to close the door to them and change the way Washington works. And, of course, as soon as he started doing health care, he sat in a room with the drug companies. He listened to the perspectives and responded to them of the insurance companies. And we got healthcare reform that improved the situation somewhat, and I don't think we should minimize the benefits that came from the reform, but it didn't address the core problems. We still have a system that's going bankrupt. The retirement health care is still the biggest single threat to the United States in terms of the fiscal imbalance associated with it, or the budgetary imbalance associated with it. And we're going to have to fix it. And frankly, the political debate in the United States seems, focused on polarizing and putting off to tomorrow what we have to deal with today.
How about would a first step be reestablishing real government regulation, which has eroded over the past 25 years, not only under Republican administrations, but also under Clinton's, where it seems they put anti-government U.S. regulators, sort of the foxes guarding the hen house.
I think there have been bad regulatory moves, and there's been government red tape, and there was a critique to be made, but the reality is that regulations are not all bad. Regulations often save a country money. If you require that the power company down the street put a scrubber on its tower, and reduce emissions, then you save money on treating people for lung diseases. You save money on the costs of degrading your environment. You save money in other kinds of ways. And so, regulations are a healthy component of a balanced system, provided they're enforced responsibly and crafted sensibly. We've unfortunately, as you indicated, went to a world where for several decades they were all bad, and Democrats and Republicans and alike were against them. And, it's no coincidence that they were against them, because it was starting to cost $1 billion to run a presidential campaign, and the only way to get $1 billion was to deal with corporate leadership. And when you ask corporate leadership what they want in exchange for their $1 billion, they would say, get off our backs. Don't regulate us. Let us do what we want to do, because we can increase our profits. We've fallen victim to that. And the campaign finance system is a key culprit.
And we go back to our callers. We've got Juan in Tamarack. Hey, Juan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question in regards to the differences in how much money the United States has between the rich and the poor, and how it's increased. I heard mentioned earlier it contributes to the influence the United States has in the world, that it's decreased because our disparity is greater. Well, didn't this disparity exist in the past, and wasn't it also observed? And if it wasn't, I'd like to know more about it, if there's anything to share.
Well, the disparity between rich and poor has always been there, and there have been periods in our history at the end of the 19th century and the 1920s where it was pretty bad. It's never been as bad as it is now. We are at the height of income inequality disparities, and there are a variety of studies been done. The University of California at Berkeley has been involved in a number of these studies where it's been demonstrated that increasingly the share of wealth and the share of income and the share of benefits of growth in our society have been accrued by the top 1% or the top 0.1%, vastly disproportionately. And they, I think the evidence is that has been accelerating since the 70s and has accelerated even more rapidly in the course of the past couple of decades.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Juan. I have an emailer here, Jim. He says, would it have been more effective if instead of an Occupy Wall Street movement, there had been an Occupy K Street movement? Of course, that's the lobbyist street in Washington.
Well, there was an Occupy movement here. In fact, Occupy Wall Street, I think, ended up with, chapters in 900 cities around the world.
I think he's saying to demonstrate against the lobbyists.
Yeah, well, and I think demonstrating against the lobbyists would be a good idea. I think a better idea would be to have an agenda, have something specific people wanted. The way to go after K Street is to change lobbying laws and to change campaign finance laws. With Citizens United decision, which I think is probably the most dangerous Supreme Court decision since the Dred Scott case in the 19th century, an observation that was made not only by me but by a member of Congress, I think that's something to organize around. That we need a law that countermands what the Supreme Court has said on this, because they're wrong about this, just like they're wrong about gun control laws. The Supreme Court is, just like they were wrong once about slavery. The Supreme Court's wrong about things periodically, and we have a system that allows checks and balances against them. And I think we need to undo this very dangerous notion that money is speech and that corporations can't have their contributions politically regulated. And we'd be a lot better off if we followed the models of other countries that have shorter campaigns, federally financed campaigns, campaigns with real limits as to what people could do, in terms of broadcast advertising and so forth, because this would start to take the money out and reduce the influence of people. And similarly, I think lobbying controls could do the same thing here in Washington.
Why is it that it seems like every effort at campaign finance reform fails? They always find loopholes somewhere.
Well, it's your fox in the henhouse problem that you brought up earlier. The people who are passing these laws are the people who are the primary beneficiaries of the screwed up system. So, their incentive to do anything about it is diminished. Because, after all, they're the ones in office. They're the ones who played the game best. They're the ones who are beneficiaries of this system. And nobody wants to move first, because who are the biggest beneficiaries of all these problems? Incumbents. We reelect incumbents, as Ronald Reagan observed 30 years ago, at a higher rate than did the Supreme Soviet of the Soviet Union.
And another caller, this is Sergio. Sergio in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was calling to ask about what you thought maybe towards the idea that this consolidation of corporations that's happening more and more is also happening with the media, to the point where we're becoming less and less capable of being critical in a meaningful manner that's not necessarily polarizing the politics of the country. And aside from that, do you think that there's any way that we could stop that? Any way that we could avoid that with things like the internet, where there's more information available than there's ever been, but people just don't always seem to have access to it. Whereas I feel like much of my younger friends are much more likely to do their research before they have an opinion about something, as opposed to where people today just watch, maybe older people just watch whatever's on the TV and they're limited to just what's available from there.
Well, you have more information. You have more information on the internet, but much of it is shallow and much of it is questionable too.
Well, like Reddit, you have a system where people upvote and downvote different comments. Mm-hmm. So when you have maybe a person who happens to know a lot, or maybe is in the field of whatever it is you're looking into, they will be probably more likely to have a louder voice. Whereas in the news, it's whoever is being interviewed at that moment, whoever is present at the moment.
I understand. David?
Well, the sad reality is that we have the potential for using the internet to have a much more informed electorate, to expose that electorate to much more diverse range of views, to connect that electorate better between parts of the country and with the rest of the world. But that's not how it works. Largely, people are choosing their news sources to receive their information in ways packaged with their politics. Fox News attracts people who lean right. MSNBC attracts people who lean left. NPR attracts people who lean left. Rush Limbaugh attracts people who lean right. they don't hear the news entirely as it is. They hear it with a spin.
Well, I was going to slow you down there on that NPR thing, but go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a big NPR fan, and I listen to NPR, but, you know, I mean, you know, listen to the callers. You know, I think you have a very thoughtful group of callers here on this show, but there hasn't been a wide range of people calling up saying, how can you say that about corporations, or how can you say that about markets, or you're a communist? You know, where, and, you know, I've gone out, National Tour wrote this book, and, you know, there are markets where you hear that. But the problem is, not pertaining to NPR, pertaining to a particular newspaper or a particular television show, the problem is that people are being selective, not on the basis of the highest quality information, but on the basis of the most comfortable information.
So people go to their particular watering hole, and that's where they get their information.
Right, and this white supremacist who did this horrible thing in this Sikh temple probably hung out on the internet with a bunch of other white supremacists, and he felt that his views were accepted in a community, and you know that's a dangerous thing. But you know it compounds other problems. And the other problems are that as younger internet users may be smarter internet users, as the caller implied, they're also apathetic. And we have a problem where, you know, half of Americans don't vote in elections, a problem that other countries don't have. I think as I've gone out and given speeches associated with this book and other things, the most common question I get is, what can I do about this? And the answer is, do something. Pick one thing that's important to you. Deal with it in your school board or in your town or in your state or in your congressional district, or deal with it somewhere. The biggest problem is that most Americans who even are interested in politics primarily are interested so they can complain about it with their friends rather than do something about it.
David Rothkopf, tell me more about you and your government career, and also a little bit about your previous book called Superclass.
My career has bounced back and forth between the media and the government, and I had a media company that looked at world's emerging markets, and I got hired into the Clinton administration to run the government's program on emerging markets. And by the time I left, I was running the International Trade Administration as acting Undersecretary of Commerce. And then I went and was a managing director of Kissinger Associates and set up a number of other companies, which fortunately have done okay. Now I have this consulting company, and I run Foreign Policy, which is a division of Washington Post Company. But I've been fortunate enough in doing this work, which is primarily focused on America's role in the world. I'm also a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment, to be able to write books. And Superclass was a bit of a predecessor to Power, Inc., and it followed out of a book I did on the U.S. government called Running the World, in which I've just been interested in the nature of power and how it's concentrated in the hands of a few people and who those people are. And you know, conspiracy theorists have one idea. They're all meeting in a room someplace and planning out things, and that's not, in my experience, the way the world works. But that's not to say that too few people don't have too much power, because they do. And they've got their thumb on the scales, and it's producing outcomes, particularly in the United States, in a disturbing way. And my view is that if you write about it, you expose it, you do it in a balanced way that's not biased in one direction or another politically, that you may actually open some eyes and make a difference.
David Rothkopf, it's time to go. We're out of time. I want to thank you for spending this hour with us. His latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Thank you very much, David.
My pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Bonnie Berman. Paul Leary gives production support. Remember, we have author and book links and much more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And tomorrow, we take a look at a list of the 100 greatest Americans of the 20th century in the vein of challenging injustice and promoting democracy. Professor Peter Dreiser joins us. And to the calendar, on this day in 1896, 116 years ago, the birth of Florida icon writer Marjorie Kennan Rawlings in Washington, D.C. Best known for The Yearling, she died in 1953. And on this day in 1968, 44 years ago, a race riot erupts in Miami's Liberty City during the Republican National Convention held on Miami Beach. Four die. And one more on this day in 1974, 38 years ago, President Richard Nixon announces he'll resign his office following new damaging revelations in the Watergate scandal. Vice President Gerald Ford is sworn in. And we leave with a thought from Richard Nixon, the only American to be elected twice to both the presidency and vice presidency. Quote, "To leave office before my term is completed is aberrant to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3 WLRN NHD1 Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and the Palm Beaches. 91.5 WKWM NHD1 Marathon Key West and streaming live at WLRN.org. The Bipartisan Cybersecurity Act of 2012 failed last week in the Senate, despite growing alarm in the national security world about vulnerabilities in the nation's critical infrastructure. Emerging Cyber Threats and the Future of Cybersecurity with guest host Tom Gelton coming up on Talk of the Nation. Downtown Hollywood is the place for live music at Arts Park Live. You can attend free weekend concerts showcasing